Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Musician's Mentor podcast. I'm your host, Travis Mark, and if you're enjoying these episodes or even our blogs, please leave us a review, a rating, or share it with your friends or musicians who you feel might get something out of this. Today I sit down and talk with renowned British jazz drummer, Mr. Pete Cater. I was lucky enough to study with Pete many years back, and he's inspired me and my playing tremendously. Pete has a list of credits that would take me really just too long to mention, but he was one of the leading instructors at Drum Tech in the United Kingdom for years. He used to write for Drummer Magazine. He has his Pete Cater Big Band, has played with Tony Kofi. He's got some drumming books out there, some drumming instructional DVDs. Long story short, Pete's just a great all-round musician, great all-round player, great all-round person. Before we get started on today's episode, I'd like to apologize in advance for some of the audio. Unfortunately, I couldn't get to my studio for today's episode, and my neighbor decided to do some landscaping. At least that's what I think happened. I couldn't get outside, but there was a lot of noise, which I've tried my best to cut out, but you will hear some every now and then, so my apologies for that. Anyway, enough of my rambling. Ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Mr. Pete Cater.
Hey, Pete, how's it going?
I'm good, Travis. How are you, man?
Good, man. Long time. How is life post-lockdown in Britain?
Hey, it's really cool, actually. Life post-lockdown has been quite a revelation because in the immediate aftermath of the restrictions being lifted, I reconnected with a jazz musician who I had worked with, I don't know, fairly regularly about 15 years ago.
Wow.
And we just found one another again. And right out of the blue, he said, look, I've got a gig coming up at Ronnie Scott's with my quartet. And would you like to do it? And I said, yeah, I would. And I did. And it was great. And then that was in the November of 2020, when we were in this kind of half in, half out scenario, which I'm sure you're perfectly familiar with.
Yeah.
So we did it at Ronnie's, and they were only allowed to sell half the house and all that kind of stuff. But it went really well, and then because everything got shut down again, and when things opened up, one of the first gigs I did had been about a week or so, 10 days maybe after things started up again, was back with this guy, Simon. And it was just great. And he said, look, do you want to join my quartet? And I said, yeah, I do. And so we've been working regularly. We've just almost completed a little run of some of the more important British jazz festivals.
Cool.
And it's been great. And it's all the things I got time to work on during lockdown, when I wasn't spending, you know what it's like. You spend enough time here. You're spending hours and hours in your car on the M25, getting absolutely nowhere.
Yeah.
And all this enforced time at home. I was fortunate that there was a certain part of my character, I guess. I didn't feel really kind of laid low by the lockdown in the way that a lot of people did. And I just saw it as an opportunity to really kind of, because I wasn't, working like 3, 4, 5 days a week, to really break free of some muscle memory habits that were in my hands, and to a lesser extent in my feet, that I've been carrying around probably since I was a teenager.
Wow.
And I knew what I wanted to do, and it was a question of getting the things that I'd worked on in the preceding years to kind of replace all this imprinted stuff that I've been doing for most of my playing life, which I managed to do. And it's been quite a revelation. And I think, like a lot of people, I spent a lot of time in the lockdown putting up little bits of video onto YouTube of ideas.
I watched those. I was quite a fan of those. But, you know, that's something, you know, I think not everybody, of course, but I think with certain musicians, and I include you in this, there has to be a certain wiring, especially if you've been one of those musicians who've been self-employed and had to look after yourself versus one of the musicians who maybe got a gig in like a really big sort of pop act in some shape or form and was a sideman for most of your career. When you're like a self-employed working musician, you've got to kind of constantly be thinking out of the box and using those times like lockdown in a productive way, I think, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot to that, and I think the other thing that works in one's favor, if the self-employed freelance, you know, jobbing musician, if that's your background, which obviously it is with me, it makes you a little bit more proactive in certain respects, in that you try to make things happen. It's not necessarily about hustling. I mean, I've always found, I've never been one of these people who could kind of try and sweet talk people into giving me work that in that kind of way. I think that will make me feel dirty. Some people are very good at that. They can turn on the charm. I've always tried to let my plane do the talking as far as that goes. But yes, if you have had a regular gig that has sustained you and, you know, this has been there, and you go on the road for like 6 months and then you take 3 months off and then you spend 3 months making a record and then the whole cycle starts out again. Some of those things for certain people, I don't think they've come back.
No.
And you know, whereas I, in my busiest times, I guess, which would have been the mid 1990s, I was working for probably about 100 different clients in any given year. Some of them would only be once or twice a year. Some of them would be several times a month. And that over time, truthfully, there are not many of those people for whom I still do things today. But having that kind of work pattern where you've got a whole Rolodex full of people who know you and will employ you, because you do a certain thing a certain way, you're obviously shortening the odds of being able to have a sustainable career. And this is what I always say to the young players who aspire to pursue drumming as a profession. And that is, you've got to be whatever kind of player the industry wants you to be on any given day. And you've also got to be able to go and play music that you don't particularly like and do so with good grace and a smile on your face.
Completely.
That's what will get you on, because, you know, it may be, you know, somebody's wedding in a hotel in the middle of nowhere, and there's nothing to eat for the band and all these scenarios that we've all seen thousands and thousands of times, but you never know who might be on that gig somebody you don't know, they might be able to make a connection for you, open the door for you, recommend you to a third party. And this is how it goes on. And I feel very, very fortunate that I have pursued that kind of pathway, that, you know, I've got a big birthday coming up in the early part of 2023. And that I'm still as busy. I mean, a couple of months this year, I think it was May and June, I was as busy as I ever was in the heyday of the mid 90s when you know, I had work coming out of my ears. Of more recent times, let's say this busy period that I've just come through, it's been the case that I'm busy doing things that I really want to do and that I really get a big kick out of. Whereas back in the 90s, a lot of the things that were keeping me busy were not quite so much fun.
Yeah, more vocation to pay the bills versus always doing the things you want to do, you know.
Well, business rather than pleasure, sure.
Yeah, completely. Well, Pete, I tell you what, let's back up a little, because I've actually started recording this from the moment we got on the call. But just to give you a little bit of a breakdown, I mean, I know I've interviewed you for various things in the past, so I obviously know quite a bit about you, and I'm a fan of your playing and your musicality, etc., etc., etc. But why don't we just back it up a little bit, and could I ask you to maybe just do a little bit of an introduction on you, what you've done, what you're up to, where you're from, your a bit of your history, just so that anybody who listens to this, you know, maybe has a better idea of where you're coming from. Because I know that you've been working for years, and I know that you're one of the, in my opinion, one of the best jazz drummers in Britain. You know, like, I think for those that might not be aware of who Pete Cater is, let's give them a bit of an introduction.
Okay, well, I am, as you rightly say, primarily, first and foremost, a jazz musician. That's always been the music of choice, and that really came about because my dad played drums. He didn't play drums for a living. He always had an office job and played in the evenings and was very busy and was a good player. But right from the very, very beginning, there was jazz in the house. The first big drummer that really was a huge influence on my life was Joe Morello with the Dave Brubeck Quartet. And, you know, to be exposed to that kind of, that level of skill, that level of musicianship, when, you know, you've just come out into the world, you've just been born, that had a really profound effect upon me. And it was as though, you know, that kind of music, you know, Brubeck Quartet, Oscar Peterson, Clifford Brown and Max Roach, Miles Davis, Jazz Philharmonic. I'm thinking all those records that we had back then when I was very small, because Buddy Rich's big band didn't come around until I was 4 or 5 years old. So that was one of my later influences. But to be around this fabulous music and where the drums were so much a part of it, and, you know, playing a leading role rather than more of the supporting role that we think of in other genres, was massively influential upon me. And consequently, I grew up wanting to, you know, have that in my life. And sure enough, with a little bit of encouragement from my dad and, you know, discovering all these drum books, magazines and stuff that he left around the house, I started to try to copy the things that I heard on his records. It's not that I didn't love pop music and rock music just as much, but it was the jazz guys that really made me want to play. That was what really got me motivated. And by the time I was 12 or 13 years old, I would go with Dad on gigs because I was very tall for my age, and I'd sit in, and that was it. By the time I was 14, I was gigging regularly, and have been ever since for the intervening 45 years.
Amazing.
And when I got older, one of the things I did want to do, and things were, you know, have to bear in mind in a time when there was no internet and no social media and things like that, the world was a less joined up place in a lot of ways than it is now. And when I was about 18 or 19 years old, the one thing I really wanted to do, because there wasn't much music education of a kind that we would recognize today. Back in the UK, back in the early 1980s, there was nowhere I could go to college. Being a self-taught player with no O-level or A-level music or no grade 5 piano or anything like that, there was really nowhere to go. And so I thought that I would like to go and study in the United States. And that would have required me having a great deal of money, which I didn't have. And so that went by I wasn't able to do that, which was, I don't particularly regret it, but I'm curious about how things might have panned out if I had done that at that time.
Yeah.
So instead of which, I formed a big band in 1982, and that was my first step into this crazy world of big band leading. And so that was the first band, which we did a few gigs over about a year or so. And then I started to look at getting away from my hometown. I mean, there was a lot of music going on in Birmingham and the towns and cities that surrounded Birmingham. But I felt that the opportunities lay elsewhere. So ultimately the goal was to get to London.
Yeah.
And to, you know, get in amongst the best musicians in the country. I mean, we had great players in the Midlands, but then as now, the very uppermost strata of musicianship, the best players all gravitated to London, and I wanted to be a part of that. And without being able to go to music college, or without being in the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, there were these very obvious pathways. I had to find another way. So, and it took a while. It took me well into my 20s to kind of find a pathway. And it took me off on this kind of crazy tour around the UK of playing summer seasons in holiday parks and pantomime and regional theatres and doing short stints on cruise ships and things like that, because I needed to get better at the job, and I wanted to make some money, and I wanted to make some contacts. And by the time I was, by the time I was 28, I'd done quite well, and I'd worked with some good people. I'd made some money. I'd managed to hang on to some money. And of course, it sounds crazy in today's times, but £5,000 then was a decent deposit on buying a property.
Yeah.
So I was able to buy myself a nice apartment on the outermost reaches of Northwest London. I didn't have any work. I only knew a couple of people, like two phone numbers. It was just a big gamble, but I'd done the best jazz gigs around Birmingham. I played with the best players. I played the best venues. And I needed to go to the next level. And I knew I had to be in London in order for that to be a possibility.
Yeah,
I mean, no leader of a jazz band in London is going to be hiring a drummer from Birmingham when there's people on the doorstep. There's no sense in that at all. And I knew that this was what had to be done. And so I got on with it. And it took a while to get going. There wasn't much jazz in the first year that I was in London. But that soon began to change. And things really, by the time I'd been in London 2 years, I guess, I got a regular, virtually as the closest thing to a full-time jazz gig as one could have at that time. And I decided to form my own big band with all, because there were so many great young musicians in London, all the guys in all the colleges. There were so many people to choose from. It was really not difficult to find plenty of people who were willing to get together and rehearse and get a band together that was really, really very, very forward-looking and very exciting. And when we launched in, April 1995, we really created a bit of a stir. In fact, some of the recordings from that very first concert that we did with the big band, you can hear on my YouTube channel. I just uploaded them a couple of months ago, and I'm going to start loading up some more stuff.
Cool.
I don't know if it's of any interest to anybody. I know a lot of the people who were in the guys in the band at the time like to hear them, and so that's primarily what they're there for. So, but it's a document of what started off very strongly, and you know, we were quite forward looking and modern in a way that, you know, some of the big bands that were out there weren't. They were a little bit more conservative with a small C, I guess. And we were playing modern music and getting away with it. And the other great thing that then happened is I started to connect with writers, composers, and arrangers. And as a result of that, we started to have our own repertoire, and this provided sufficient material to make a worthwhile debut album, which we did in 1997.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit about band leadership, because, you know, I mean, obviously leading a big band is, well, I would imagine, I've never led a big band myself, but I would imagine leading a big band is quite intense in comparison to leading any band, yet leading any band can be quite a stressful workload. You know, you're trying to juggle people's schedules, you're trying to work around people's lives, there's moods, there's emotions, etc. So, I mean, I suppose the question doesn't have to apply to big bands per se, but what kind of advice or tips could you offer people who want to start working with other musicians in a leadership type role, whether it's as a musical director or as a leader, on just trying to, you know, keep the wheels turning and keeping different personalities happy?
Well, this is the thing with any collective, where there's an element of leadership involved. And it's like if you run a you know, away from music, if you run a company, you know, if you're a businessman, if you employ people, there are always going to be, you know, a lot of personalities to deal with, and I think more than anything else, the single most important thing is to make sure you've got the right people around you, And you know, you make mistakes occasionally, and the longer you work with people, the more you get to know about them. And I have only had, in all the years since from 1995 up until 2018, which was the last gig we did prior to the pandemic, because we kind of come to a logical end of a chapter and what the band had been doing. There's only definitely one, maybe two musicians who I employed during that period who I don't care if I never see again.
Yeah.
But the thing with that, of course, is I always tried to give musicians things that they would really dig playing. You know, it's not like I'm asking them to play like a commercial big band, you know, like a Glenn Miller type show or a Rat Pack kind of show. When you are offering guys proper professional fees to play big band jazz, you can be pretty sure of having quite a lot of support from the musicians, which is why it's all the more disappointing in a way if you have someone in the band who turns out to be a dickhead.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I'm paying you, like, I don't know, whatever I was paying them at the time, like £140 a gig. And you don't know how to behave. Of all the musicians that I employed, and there were a lot, it runs into probably, you know, a couple of hundred.
Wow.
One way or another. And there are only two or three of them who I would never book again.
I mean, that's pretty impressive, you know?
Yeah.
It speaks volumes for your own character, I think, stuff like that, you know. I get into these discussions sometimes with musicians, sometimes with staff at venues, just about certain things. And what blows my mind when you, again, you know, this might not always apply depending on the sort of place where you're at musically. But like for me personally, as a working musician myself, I find it like quite disheartening sometimes when I'm around people, and you know, I, like you, I seem to have found a bit of a niche in regards to, I play for a few different people, and that's how I make up my salary each month, if you want to call it a salary. But sometimes I'm around some people who, you know, I kind of bite my tongue and I sit back and don't really say much about it because I know my role as a sideman and that's all good. But sometimes I find it quite interesting how certain individuals will find any and every reason to complain and moan about the situations they're in gig-wise.
Yeah, I know.
And, yeah, man, yeah. It drives me nuts because it's like, it's almost like, have they not considered the alternative? You know, you're getting paid pretty good money to be at a place for usually minimal amounts of time. Now, sure, you might not, you know, be playing, I don't know, the O2 Arena, and maybe that's where you feel you need to be or something, but that's not the musicians you're working with's problem. And I feel like there needs to be, you know, I know that, like, nowadays, you know, to go back to what we've spoken about already, you know, there wasn't always a lot of music instruction and education. Now it's at the tip of your fingers. You type in anything. There's courses on everything. There's millions of lessons of everything. There's numerous colleges you can go to and institutes you can go to. And I mean, it's amazing. But for me personally, I think it would be a really good idea to start implementing. I know that a lot of these places teach music business, but like the whole idea behind like this podcast and the website and stuff like that is just to try and like maybe, hopefully at least, start trying to educate. Wow, sorry, there must be a plane or something going past. We get these fighter jets that fly over most mornings, and I think we just had one. but I think, you know, it needs to be spoken about more. The openness of just being grateful for what you have if you're working in this industry, personally.
I absolutely get that. And at the beginning of our chat today, I was talking a little bit about my great friend and colleague, Simon Stewart,
who I reconnected with during the lockdown and I'm now working with all the time, both in his quartet and his big band. And I'm actually going to be producing his big band album in the end of this year, beginning of next year. And he tells me many stories of some of the people he's employed who would turn up with a bad attitude. And here I am, as I mentioned earlier, I'm going to be 60 years of age in February next year. I'm doing the best gigs I've ever done. And that's nothing to do with money or profile, but in terms of personal artistic fulfillment, I'm doing the best gigs I've ever done in my life. I'm on the A-list of the British jazz scene, more emphatically than at any time in all the years prior to now. And things have worked out exactly the way I planned, I think hoped is probably closer to the truth than planned. So why wouldn't I turn up with a good attitude? And it amazes me sometimes when I see the how some people behave and some of the negativity that's out there. It's like, well, you know, it's a privilege to be able to do this. When I say it's a privilege, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be, you know, properly treated and paid appropriately. But I feel very lucky to be where I am at this point in my life. And if I had, as you said earlier on, had like a big gig with a big artist that kept me fully employed year in and year out, through my 20s and 30s, perhaps, then there's every possibility that I wouldn't be in music anymore.
Yeah, and you know, again, it's like maybe it's an age thing, and I don't mean in terms of a life age thing. I think more in a terms of a musical age thing that maybe you just start to appreciate it. Because, you know, I'm sure it must be the same for you, but what I've noticed over my years is that, like, you know, it seems like, and I've discussed this with some of the other people that I've spoken to, but for me, I've noticed a definite pattern over the you know, the last decade, where it almost becomes like a New Year's resolution for some people. You know, most Januaries I get calls from a lot of my part-time musician friends, and I'm not saying being a part-time musician is a bad thing. I don't think anything with music is bad. But they suddenly want to do music full-time. And usually within a sort of 6-week to 12-week period, that has completely gone by the wayside, and they're back to doing what they were doing, and they're so quick to be negative about the music industry. Yet,
well, this is the same as people who join the gym every January.
Completely.
And go for 2 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the thing is, like, I think, you know, sort of, I just think it's a, we got to start practicing gratitude more, you know, even in the worst scenarios. And again, I'm totally in agreeance when, you know, that is not to say that we should just be stepping stones and treated like dirt at certain venues or events. I'm not trying to praise or accept that at all. I just think that if you are lucky enough to find something you're passionate about, and you are obviously passionate about drumming and music, and you get to do that for your life, man, you've got to come to the realization at some point, and I'm not saying you personally, I'm meaning people in general, you have to realize at some point that you're extremely blessed, because most people go through their whole lives working a job that they hate, and they're very unhappy by the time they sort of reach their late 30s, 40, and they want to constantly change, but they can't get out because that's all they know.
I can tell you this. My wife is sitting downstairs with a couple of friends, and they have like a little executive hang on a Friday afternoon. And one of the guys, he's a little bit younger than me, and he's had a senior boardroom position at a big British company, and he's recently retired. And he looks at me sometimes with, I mean, not envy, but, you know, admiration that I've managed to spend my life doing something that's an absolute blast. And as you said, it's like they're like the self-help gurus like to say about having an attitude of gratitude, but it's absolutely true. And this post-lockdown period for me has been extraordinary, in as much as things have really gone up a gear, and because of certain affiliations that I've already mentioned, my career is at a high watermark, and I'm very much hoping that it's going to, at the very worst, stay where it is, or even better still, you know, keep moving forward, and there may be new worlds to conquer out there that I haven't even thought of yet. And you know, I see really big hitter players who get to my age, and you know, some guys who've had some of the most distinguished, glittering careers in the industry over many, many decades. And sometimes they don't seem very happy with where they've ended up. And I think that's terribly sad. And, you know, I can think of one or two household name brothers whose output on social media almost kind of makes you think that, are you okay? I think that's very, very disappointing for them. And so quite sad in a way that you would get to a point where you felt that way, if music made you feel that way. I actually set myself after a very tedious Sunday night concert in Cardiff in 1997 with the BBC Big Band, I actually made a little rule after that gig, and it was that I would always try to never come home from a gig liking music less than when I left the house.
That's a great rule to have, actually.
It is. It's a bit of a tough one, and there's always going to be times when you're going to be compromised, because you're just going to have to take that. You need that £150, and you're just going to have to suck it up and do it.
Yeah.
But if you can prioritize the things that make you happy, I would rather play music I love for £100 than music I really dislike for £150.
Oh yeah, completely. Because again, that affects your psyche and your. I don't want to use the word the term mental health, but it definitely. I mean, how many times in your life have you gotten in the car traveling home after a gig and thought to yourself, "Oh man, I shouldn't have done that one." You know.
Yeah. Well, because of this little house rule that I instigated now 25 years ago, it's been a very long time since it happened to me. And, you know, obviously there are sometimes things that that go against you that make what you're doing a little harder to bear. For instance, last Saturday, I was on a festival and there was a rented drum set there provided for me, and you know, it all looked okay. And then, of course, this is for a jazz festival, so it's supposed to be a jazz drum set, and the sizes were kind of approximately right, if not entirely ideal. And then closer scrutiny brought me to the realization that the bass drum was absolutely full of like somebody's bed linen or something, and somebody had put pinstripe heads on the bottom of the toms.
Oh, so, I actually saw your Facebook post about this. Yeah, that's beautiful.
That was not cool at all. But I got on with it. I was very disappointed with the gig because I felt that I really wasn't able to do what I can do with my own drums. And of course the trunk of hardware that came with it was all heavy duty stuff, as so many rented sets tend to have. And I don't know if you're across this one, but the effect that really heavy hardware has on the performance of your drums and cymbals is really quite dramatic, and I think a lot of people fail to realize this. So yeah, heavy hardware, wrong heads on the bottom of the toms, bass drum full of bed linen, and it was hotter than hell in the concert hall as well. So it made it harder than it needed to be. As you have observed, there was a Facebook post about it. And then, of course, what happens today? But I read a review of the concert, and it's, you know, it's like one of the most positive reviews of one of my performances that I've read in years. So, you know, what do you do? I knew it wasn't happening. It's like every time. Because obviously in a gig like this, there's a lot of soloing involved. Every time I moved away from the snare to the toms, it was suddenly like I was trying to play a cushion. You know, with those double coin heads on the bottom of the drums, they just really weren't moving the way they should. And then, you know, the reviewer's perspective is just like incredibly effusive, positive review. And I know I'm right and he's wrong, but I'll take it. You know, I'll take it.
Well, and yeah, you got to take it.
it makes me feel better about. I mean, if this reviewer, you know, he's got a bit of a reputation around the jazz industry of not pulling any punches, and if he'd been, you know, in any way negative about what I'd done, that would have added insult to injury, I think.
Yeah. But
no, it's a very positive review. The link to it on my Facebook page. And you know, I know I'm right. I know I didn't do my best work by any stretch of the imagination. That was Saturday. That group played again Tuesday night, and I'm obviously back to carrying my own drums, and it was just like, you know, everything was happening, everything was going on. Everything I was thinking of was coming out of my hands and feet, and I was really very, very much in the zone in a way that I knew I hadn't been on Saturday. And, you know, I think even with the gig where things are not quite as you wish, it's very important that you don't beat yourself up. And I'm very fair on myself. If I feel that I haven't done my best work on a gig, I'll have a think about why. And, you know, without, say, beating myself up, being down about things, I'll just get in the practice room and I'll address it. And this is what informs a lot of the practicing that I do. I practice because of the music that I'm going to be playing and because of the music that I have played. You know, if I've got things coming up in the diary that require me to do certain things particularly, then I'll make sure I'm match fit.
Yeah.
And similarly, if things haven't gone as well as I might have hoped they would, then I'll pick everything apart and sort it out. And the rest of the time, when I'm not doing ticking either of those two boxes, then I'm just carrying on with this lifetime of personal creative development, which just fascinates me. It just keeps me there, you know, at the drawing board every day, looking for new and different ways of doing things. If you're creative in your practice, it becomes a habit. So I know that every time I sit down to practice, I'll have a new idea. Some of them are good. Some of them are amazing. Some of them end up being no use at all. But I mean, I practice from a very creative perspective, and I'm lucky that the music that I play gives me full rein to use these things that I develop. I mean, I work on hand techniques, it fascinates me. I work on time and dynamics because that's what other people want from me. I work on improvisation across the board because the music that I play has a great deal of scope for improvisation. And I feel very lucky that, you know, what I do at home, I can take straight to the workplace. It's not like I'm in a West End theatre playing the same same music, you know, time and time again, 8 times a week with no scope for creativity or whatever.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a second. So staying motivated as a musician in itself is again, it's a challenge, you know, both from a practice point of view, both from a employment point of view, both in a trying to get work point of view. So do you think that's an art that can be learnt? And if so, what do you think people can do to try and get better at staying motivated?
Setting yourself goals, knowing where you want to be, having targets that you want to hit, whether that's you want to hit a certain level of playing or a certain level of achievement in the industry, having that steely eye in a forward direction, looking at where you want to be, having an outcome that you're trying to achieve. That's the biggest motivator. If you're just kind of drifting, and not really sure about what it is you're doing or why you're doing it, then it's likely that you're not going to progress, because if you don't know where you're going, if you don't know what the destination is, there's no way you can find a direction to get there. So I think the first thing you have to decide, and I decided this long ago, I mentioned West End Theatre a few minutes ago. Back in the mid-90s, I had the opportunity to go down that route. And one of the big theatre contractors called me up, and he had a tour that was going out around the UK and then on into the West End of London. And I turned him down because I was already – the jazz career was doing okay, not as much money ultimately – as I would have earned if I'd gone down the theatre route, but I was able to retain, you know, my integrity as an artist and kind of validate what I was doing. I was doing, even then, what was I then? About 32. Even then, I was already morphing into the drummer I dreamed about becoming when I was 5 or 6 years old.
Amazing.
And, you know, it's very important to remember where you come from, to remember what it was that motivated you in the first instance, what it was that inspired you to get good at this, you know, at all. And that's exactly, I've always kept that in mind all the way down the line. And through a combination of, I guess, very, very good fortune and hard work, it's all worked out really well. And it feels like this last 15 months since things opened up again, I've been hitting a new level, both in terms of my playing and in terms of my perceived status in the industry here in the jazz business here in the UK, which is, well, whatever that greater power is out of my window, thank you very much. You know, very, very happy man. And being happy in that way and having a, you know, a very settled and happy home life as well, which is important too, means that I'm full steam ahead. I've got a lot still to do. I've got a lot of ambition still left. I got a new agent last year, which was not something I was planning on. I wasn't going out trying to get on the books of an agency, but a specialist music agency approached me, and they said they were looking at extending their jazz roster. So as far as they're concerned, I've been in the laboratory a little bit, developing ideas for a new big band format, which I'm hoping we're going to have the time and the opportunity to launch in the spring of next year. And as I said, I've got my record producer hat, dusting that off at the moment, and I've got two or three things that I'm planning to do, maybe even four, that I'm looking forward to getting involved in. So being producer and player as well, looking at starting up a little label, and doing things that have, you know, quality, niche market, specialist music releases. You're not going to find them on YouTube or Spotify or any streaming service of any kind. It's going to be strictly physical products, CDs first, vinyl later, and that's something I'm very excited about. So I think I've produced four albums in my life, and I'm looking forward to getting back in that chair again very soon.
Yeah, that sounds good, man. Keep us posted on that as well, because obviously as and when things happen, you know, I'll let people know.
That's great, man. Appreciate that.
Well, Pete, I'm gonna honor our time, so I know I've only got you for a short while still, but I want to just cover one or two other things, if that's okay. I know that you've always been quite involved in education and teaching, and you know, you used to do articles for Drummer magazine and those kinds of things. Let's just talk about education for a second. And I want to throw a little bit of a twist on it because, again, you know, I'm trying to keep this away from your standard, you know, let's ask the same questions everybody asks kind of thing.
Yeah.
So obviously, it's a given music education is important. You know, that's been established for years now. We don't need to go down that route. But what I would like to kind of get some insight on is, you know, obviously, let's talk a little bit about your approach as an educator, but also I'd like to know your opinions on, you know, there's a lot of up and coming young people who want to be musicians, and I'm using that term young people possibly a little bit too loosely, because I know it's people of all ages, but I, in my personal experience, have seen a lot of people who get sort of stigmatized by this, oh yeah, I studied at such and such a place, yet they haven't necessarily put the work in to become what they think they should be just because they studied at such and such a place. So I'd like to just know your opinions on, you know, what good do you think music education is if the people who are sometimes going to these places are really just using it as a, almost as a status versus an actual practical thing that they want to achieve?
Okay. Well, in terms of purely, if we classify instrumental education as the acquisition of knowledge and facility about your chosen instrument, there is big. Here comes a big bomb. There is absolutely no need for anybody to go to music college at all. You can, with the right private tuition, you know, the right guidance, you can get as good as anybody who goes to the most expensive conservatoire on the face of this earth. However, really, the point of the whole thing is the peer group. It's the student peer group. It's the tutor peer group. If you live in, I don't know, somewhere in Wyoming, and you're the greatest new jazz drummer since sliced bread, the best you can possibly hope to be is the best jazz drummer in Wyoming, and not that many people are probably going to know about you. So what you have to do is put yourself in New York City or Los Angeles or Boston or Chicago or Nashville or wherever. And the point then is, the, as I say, it's the peer group. It's being around the people who share the same aspirations that you have. And that thing, you know, you've got to go where the industry is, basically. And going to music college is one of the best ways that there is of doing that. Okay, does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. It's almost like you kind of create a network of contacts that might employ you should you,
sure.
You know,
sure.
Again, go back to what we said earlier, should you maybe have a decent attitude, you know?
Yeah.
And what about your approach as a teacher? Have you got any unorthodox things that you try and implement within your teaching style?
My teaching is completely my approach to teaching is completely maverick. It's not like anything that anybody else does that I've seen. It's all stuff that's just I've arrived at through years and years and years of I don't know, just trial, experimentation and so on. And just doing things my own way. And the things that I share with people are things that I've done myself, and I know that they work. And it's very much as simple as that.
Amazing.
My approach to technique is completely at odds with what everybody else does. The whole idea of the fulcrum in the stick hold, I completely reject that. I've got a totally different approach to that. My approach to how we use the drum set in terms of orchestration is completely my own. And really, the thing with that is this is all stuff that I've done for myself.
Yeah.
Because I've set out to achieve certain things that I've identified in my playing, that I wanted to get together. And so all of this has been entirely because I wanted to be able to do things a particular way.
Yeah.
And so what then happens with the teaching, with my publications, you know, I've done a book and a DVD. I then distill down the core stuff that I think is, and do it in a way that is accessible and makes sense to potential end users, and keep it, you know, not smoke and mirrors, not trying to blind people with science, but saying that we're doing this. This is a, there's a reason why we're doing this. It's very simple to understand. And there are clear and tangible benefits which will make you a better musician. And that's what underwrites all my approach to education, not, you know, showing people stuff that's complicated or unnecessary. What I try to do is demystify and explain to people that all the stuff that we do is all very closely connected, and it's all very based on a very small amount of information, a small amount of knowledge. A lot of people don't realize that everything your hands will ever do is based on 12 very small sticking possibilities, four of which consist of two notes, and the remaining eight of which consist of three notes. And everything else that your hands will ever do is composites of those key elements. And so by approaching this things in this way, it makes it less daunting, less intimidating for the student. And think, hey, actually, because I've seen with a lot of the colleges I've taught at, where students kind of became overwhelmed by, they felt pressurized to absorb all of this apparently necessary material. And it's what it is. It's just the same stuff dressed up in a different way. And it, you know, it's no fault of the tutors, a large part of the time, because they haven't arrived at the realization that's what's going on. And I, you know, I think a lot of teaching could be done better than it is. But hey, that's another conversation altogether.
Yeah. Okay, Pete. Last question, and it's a bit of a fully loaded one. I've asked everybody, and I'm sure I've probably asked you in the past before, but let's go with it anyway. What do you think is the best piece of advice you've ever received in regards to your music career?
I'll tell you that. It's an easy answer, and it wasn't from a drummer. It was from a trumpet player, and he was a fabulous lead trumpet player in the UK. He was first call on all the, you know, all the big studio work and things like that. And he was a guy called Derek Watkins, and he was universally respected and admired by all the musicians in our corner of the industry. And, you know, all the big guys in America knew who he was as well and respected him equally. And I think it was on the first gig that we actually ever did together, about 27 years ago at the Royal Albert Hall. And you know, he was a big personality. He was quite a, not intimidating, but, you know, you knew who was boss on the gig when Derek was there. And he just, in a break, we were in the bar, and he just said, he said to me, he said, you know what? He said, play so well that people can't ignore you.
That's cool.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's cool. Simple, but so powerful, you know?
Yeah.
All right, Pete, thank you so much for your time, man. And I'll put show note links into the notes for your albums, your DVD, your book, your website, your band, everything. But I can't thank you enough. I appreciate your time, man.
It's my absolute pleasure, man. It's really great to hook up with you again and come up to speed and, you know, find out what you've been doing. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you, Pete, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, be well, Travis. Take care. Thank you, buddy.
Bye.
Well, there we have it. Another episode done and dusted. I'd like to take the time to thank Pete for his time, and I would like to graciously thank each and every one of you for listening. As mentioned previously and in prior episodes, if you are getting something from this, please share it with your musician friends or anybody who you feel might benefit from some of the information and things that we talk about in these conversations. My name is Travis Mark. You can find out more about Musicians Mentor at musicians-mentor.com. And until next time, keep your head down, practice hard. Peace.